Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Amy Connor, whose new novel is Million Dollar Road, and Barry Bronston, author of Walking New Orleans. Amy Connor drew on her life as a horse trainer for her first published novel, The Right Thing. And in her new book, Million Dollar Road, she draws on two former lives, one as a runway model, and more than that, she drew on a real bit of Louisiana life. For 20 years, Amy and her then husband owned the world's largest alligator farm. And if you've ever wondered what that life would be like, you'll be delighted with Million Dollar Road. Amy Connor, welcome back to The Reading Life.
It's great to be here, Susan.
I'm so happy for you. This book is so much fun to read.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Now, like The Right Thing, this is a novel of female friendship and how it grows over time, isn't it?
Yes.
What drew you to these three characters, these three women? They're all very different.
Well, it's difficult to say. It's more that I knew all these women, and as the book progressed, it all started with the original character, Lorraine the hoser. And the more I wrote about her, the more I realized that I needed other characters to balance her. And they just sort of appeared. That's usually the way it works with me.
Now, tell us what a hoser is, Amy.
It's a tough job. Back when we owned the alligator farms, we actually had three. Four, if you wanted to count the one in Felda. We needed to make sure that the barn stayed clean. And an alligator farm is a dirty place. And between the mud, the spilled alligator feed, just the general muck of an alligator farm, we wanted to have the cement aisles hosed every day so that they would be clean, because it catches up with you in a hurry and it can be filthy. And so we would hire these girls. They were usually girls, most of them high school dropouts. Often they had children, very few of them that were older than 21 years old. And we paid them better than minimum wage, but it still wasn't very much money at all. You couldn't live on it. And I became friends with a couple and got to know them and their families a little bit. But it was such a wretched job that hardly anyone stayed for very long.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very dramatic job and not one you hear much about, obviously.
No, I don't think it's something you could actually put on your resume.
Mm-hmm. And then you have an organic farmer.
Emma, yeah.
I love her.
Yeah, I'm glad you do. She was a character that was pretty dear to my heart, because Emma is, she's so tenderhearted that she almost really isn't able to function in the world without a lot of framework, and organic gardening gave her that.
And a trophy wife.
Oh, she was the most fun. well, because trophy wives are, they can either be really boring or really fun, at least in my experience, because I've met a bunch of them. And when I sent the manuscript off to my editor in New York, he sent me back a note that said, I really want to like Lizzie, but I can't. We need to work on that. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a lot of time showing why Lizzie had become the trophy wife that she was. She'd grown up in poverty, and she was determined she was never going to live like that again. And so it was very much a life and business decision for Lizzie, as well as a romantic one.
And these women are all bound together by their relationships with Con Costello.
That's right. And he was easier to write about than, say, Lorraine was, because, again, I've known several men like Con, and it was not difficult to write about him. Again, a difficult character to humanize, because when you see men that behave in such a, well, they cut such a wide swath, and they're such ladies' men, that you tend to see only the more obvious sides of them, and you don't understand that there's usually a lot more going on beneath the surface.
So, set the stage. So, Lizzie, trophy wife.
Right.
Emma, ex-wife.
Right.
Lorraine,
Con's brand new love interest. That's right.
So which one was easiest for you to write?
Lizzie.
Really?
Yes, but I got the most satisfaction from writing about Emma because I felt like Emma had the most growth.
That's fantastic. Now, tell us about the title. Tell us what Million Dollar Road is.
Well, there is a road, a big one, in Covington, or out from Covington in St. Tammany Parish, called Million Dollar Road. And lots of times when I lived over there, people would say, oh, let's go ride down Million Dollar Road, because they were thinking they were going to be seeing huge, you know, like mansions and horse farms. And there were a few horse farms out there, but it's really rural and at the time was actually quite impoverished. And it was called Million Dollar Road because the WPA during the 30s and 40s drained the area and paved it and turned it into a pretty good road. But that's why it's called Million Dollar Road. And one of our primary alligator farm was just off of Million Dollar Road.
Wow.
But I also wanted to call the novel Million Dollar Road because this novel is set against the backdrop of the early 2000s, when everybody was spending money like crazy, putting everything on credit cards, remortgaging their houses, buying houses they couldn't afford. And it seemed to me at the time that it was a bubble. And when the bubble finally burst, it left a lot of people in a really bad way. And I'm thinking that Million Dollar Road is not just a description of the area, but it's also kind of encapsulates the spirit of the time.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about this other female character in your book called Snowball.
Oh, yeah. Snowball is an actual, I don't know if Snowball's still alive, but Snowball was one of the first leucistics that we had ever found. We were one of the first to go out and do massive egg collection in the marshes. And I could tell you right now about the Louisiana Egg Collecting Program and the Putback Program and how it really is a wonderful environmental program. It really has driven the resurgence, not to say the almost infestation of alligators that we have now. There is no alligator shortage at all. But when we found these eggs, there were four of them, I believe, and they all hatched. And one went to the Audubon Zoo, one went to a zoo in Austin, and one died, and the other became sort of like a farm pet. Mm-hmm. And she was named Snowball because she was white, and as she stayed with the farm over the years that we had it, she became incredibly familiar with humans, and that's not a good thing because an alligator is natively shy. And Snowball had gotten so accustomed to human beings that she wasn't afraid of us at all and was a little bit dangerous. And when last I saw her, she was 9 feet. And so when I wrote this book, I figured, well, she might be 11 by now. An alligator's size is really only limited by its range and its ability to, you know, snare and consume prey.
Well, read us that passage from Snowball's point of view, would you?
Well, this is when Snowball is in her tank at the alligator farm. Late August 2004. Something within Snowball craved blood and bone. These were mere abstractions, however, for she had no experience of either. From birth, her diet consisted of a milled feed, nutritionally balanced pellets of fish meal, antibiotics, and corn, similar to dog kibble, instead of ligament and sinew, muscle and fascia, rib and vertebrae. Still within the confines of her walnut-sized brain, Snowball knew as surely as she knew the dimensions of her 15-by-20, 6-foot-deep tank that she had been designed by nature to smash her mighty hinged jaws around the struggling prey, to dive beneath the surface of her world and hold the terrified animal underwater until it ceased to breathe. Then she would have been able to feed at her leisure. A soggy clump of this morning's offering drifted past her massive snout. Snowball snatched at it with indifference, throwing back her huge milk-white head, and the clotted mass of pellets vanished down her pink gullet. Within the long barn, in all the other tanks, 20,000 other captives thrashed and smacked the water as they launched upon their feed in explosive hunger, the lesser animals shoved aside in a ritualized choreography of dominance and surly submission. Together, they lived 55 to a tank in saurian tangles, but Snowball lived alone. And when the two legs came for the rest of the alligators in the BFG barn, wound their jaws shut with duct tape and dragged them out of their tanks onto the cement floor, never to be seen again, Snowball remained after they were long gone. The rarest of her kind, a white alligator Mississippiensis, she would abide.
And she does.
Indeed.
And I can just see that alligator barn. It's terrifying.
And there were, I think we had 20 of them, and that was just on the one farm. At one point, we had 250,000 alligators.
You're a brave woman. You know that?
I really didn't have to deal with them very often. You know, the hosers probably got to know them a lot better than even the farm workers because they were around them all the time.
So what's next for you? You've been a private investigator, too. You've got all these other things to draw on. What are you going to turn to next?
Well, I'm still writing. I'm working on a third novel at the moment, and it's been giving me fits for 18 months. And so I'm hoping to finish it by the end of the summer. And I'm just looking forward to having more time to write.
Well, I have to tell you, it's like you made this great leap with the second book. You know, these characters are so interesting and some of them are so endearing. And you just keep turning the pages to see what's going to happen. And it's pure delight. This is the perfect beach book.
I really appreciate you saying that because this book was sort of a problem child. Working with 4 points of view, 5 if you count Snowball, and I think you should. That was difficult. But more than anything, I wanted to make sure that these characters were whole and fully realized because it would have been easy to turn all of them into caricatures.
Well, it's deeply satisfying. This ought to be in everybody's speech book bag.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
We've been talking with Amy Connor, whose new novel is Million Dollar Road. You can meet her Tuesday, May 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Amy, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
I remember when Rock was young. Me and Susie had so much fun. Holding hands and skimming stones. Had an old Chevy and a place of my own. But the biggest gig I ever got was with a thing called the Crocodile Rock. While the other kids were rocking round the clock, we were hopping and bobbing to the Crocodile Rock. Well, Crocodile Rocking is something shocking when your feet just can't keep still. I never knew me a better time, and I guess I never will.
Barry Bronston is the Assistant Director for Public Relations at Tulane University, where she landed after a long, wonderful career at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Her new book is Walking New Orleans, a great collection of 30 walking tours to help visitors and natives explore our city. Barry, old friend, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here with you, Susan.
Now, you're a New Orleans native. You've lived here all your life, except for some time away at school. And you knew a lot of this stuff before you started the book, I think. So what did you learn about our city by writing it?
You know, it's funny. I felt like I knew a lot about the city. And, you know, in my years at the Times-Picayune, and I mentioned this in the introduction, you know, it gave me this up-close view of the city and got to visit a lot of places and experience a lot of things. But it wasn't until I started doing this book that I learned just little bits and pieces about the neighborhoods that we have in New Orleans that I did not know before. So another thing that I mentioned in the book is the fact that I think a lot of natives tend to take New Orleans for granted and don't get out in the city as much as, say, a newcomer or a visitor who wants to just take it all in and soak it all up. And, you know, we natives, I mean, yeah, we get out there, but we don't explore it like a lot of the newer people to New Orleans do. So I looked at this as an opportunity to do just that, learn more about the city than I did. So there are neighborhoods in the book that I didn't know a lot about. One of the tours is Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. And I knew that at one time that that neighborhood had been a real thriving neighborhood for Jewish and African-American owned businesses.
Right.
But over the years, you had a lot of people moving out to the suburbs, and the stores that had been on what was known as Dryad Street ended up closing shop. And it was pretty much, you know, a dormant neighborhood, I guess, until Cafe Reconcile opened. That was one of the first businesses, if you want to call it that, opened on Aretha Castle Haley. And then after Katrina, it just blossomed.
Right.
You know, people say, well, what's one of your favorite neighborhoods in the book? And that is one of my favorite neighborhoods in the book because of everything that's happening there. And I tried at the very last minute to get in as much as I could. And I know that people buy this book and there'll be something in there that
came along since.
Came along since.
Right. You know, there are 30 tours, all different neighborhoods. Besides O.C. Haley, what are some of the other tours you especially liked?
Obviously, I enjoyed the Garden District and the French Quarter. And those are the tours that really, I think, attract the tourists. Mm-hmm. But I also enjoyed going into Bywater and Faubourg St. John, that whole Esplanade, Bayou mm-hmm. St. John area, which is just stunning to walk along Esplanade.
Is.
And to, you know, see the beautiful homes, that's a great walking neighborhood, not just because of the architecture, but because there's lots of restaurants that you can walk to. You have the Bayou, and that was a great neighborhood that I enjoyed walking in. Tremé, of course, was wonderful. And a lot of people were walking uh-huh. in Tremé. And one of the most challenging things about this book was figuring out what to include and what was not going to be included.
Right.
And, you know, I felt like there were so many historical neighborhoods. Algiers Point is another one that I just absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm.
And another neighborhood that I didn't know a lot about, particularly, I had heard that there was a rich musical tradition in
yes.
Algiers Point. I really didn't know that much about it, who had lived in Algiers Point. And, you know, Algiers Point has that whole section with sculpture and memorials to various musicians. And I didn't really know a lot about that.
But you learned.
But the research that I did into some of these neighborhoods really taught me a lot. It doesn't go deep into the history of some of these neighborhoods. It kind of gives just a flavor mm-hmm. of what each of these neighborhoods offers. But I think it comes across really well in terms
and
of that.
You've made it so family friendly, which I think is something that a lot of people still don't appreciate about New Orleans. It's a great place to raise kids. It's a great place to bring kids for
exactly.
experience.
Exactly. And you may remember a book that I did
yes.
back in the early 2000s. It was a family guide for New Orleans, not family-friendly places to take your children. And so I knew from that book that there were certain places that I wanted to revisit. For instance, the various parks that we have.
And Storyland, which
you know,
is my favorite.
City
you know?
Park is in there. And the way City Park has recovered since Katrina, that's another amazing story.
And so much nature is in this
yes.
book. That's
yes.
a really
Jean
great.
Lafitte. People do not think when they're looking to explore parks, either they don't want to get in their car and drive there because you do, it does take a little bit of an effort mm-hmm. to get in the car and drive there, but it's really not as far as it might seem to get to Jean Lafitte National Park. And that was a great tour. And hopefully people will take advantage of that.
Hopefully they'll get to see some alligators. I mean.
There are alligators there. You can't miss them.
So tell me how you put it together, because it is so easy to follow. You have maps, you have narrative directions good for people like me, and then you have summaries and time durations. So what was the process for pacing this book
well,
out for you?
Well, one of the things that did make it easier for me is that this book, which is published by Wilderness Press, is modeled after several other books that they had already published. In fact, when I was debating as to whether or not I was going to take this on, they had sent me the books for the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, mm-hmm. as well as Baltimore, which are two of the cities that they have similar books to. So it sort of follows the same pattern, which kind of, I wasn't like reinventing the wheel or anything. So that kind of made it a little bit easier to do. So like I said, they all follow that same pattern. Each chapter starts out with a little bit of a introduction, and then you do sort of a kind of a step-by-step, here's this, here's that. And again, one of the challenging things is because of space is not everything could be mentioned.
Of course. We have an abundance of places here.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. Just the restaurant community alone is, you know.
Oh, I love it when you write about Ferrette and say, of course, there's no law against stopping in every place for taste.
Well, as you may have noticed, we titled that chapter Feeding Frenzy.
Exactly. That's what it is.
Because you could easily have a bite to eat at each one of those places.
So you have covered the city. I think this could do double duty as a fitness program.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to mention is the fact that walking is, it's such a I'm not a fitness expert, but I know, you know, walking is great exercise. And, you know, you may have a gym to go to, which is great. I go to a gym a couple of times a week, but it's still not the same as walking in a neighborhood. And granted, you may not walk the same pace that you would if you were at a gym, because you might stop at different places along the route of one of these neighborhoods. But it's still great exercise.
Absolutely.
And I guess if there's a downside, some of these tours I did do in the middle of the summer. And
whoa.
Yeah. I tried not to do so many of those, but I would recommend, I'm not going to tell you not to do one in the summer, but fall and spring are probably, and winter too, to a certain extent,
yes,
are the best times to do these walks.
I'm checking your shoes to see if they're worn out down there. So
you've done some walking.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Barry Bronston, whose new book is Walking New Orleans. You can meet her Saturday, May 30th from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop. Barry, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this, and I hope the readers enjoy it as well.
They will.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to
many people, both individually and collectively, contribute to literary life in New Orleans. There's so many ways to be part of the scene here: writing, publishing, networking, putting on festivals, supporting libraries, teaching. This week, I'd like to celebrate someone who's contributed in many ways to the life of our city. And that's Baird Amos, children's book author, illustrator, teacher, publisher, facilitator. Her contributions to the New Orleans book world have been both numerous and substantial. I first met Barrett in 1986 when a landmark conference of Louisiana women writers took place at Loyola University. She was on a panel I was moderating, and when I introduced her, she was quick to add to my list of her literary accomplishments. "And I have 6 sons," she said. That is vintage Barrett. Love of family, hand in hand with love of art and books and writing. Full disclosure, one of those sons, Jim Amos, would later be my boss for more than 20 years when I was book editor at the Times-Picayune. Barrett's distinctive and charming artistic style got her foot in the door of children's book publishing in the 1960s, and she worked with such luminaries as Susan Hirschman and the legendary Ursula Nordstrom. She is the author, illustrator of more than 20 picture books. Some were drawn from family life, like Tom in the Middle. Others drew on our watery landscape, like Old Hannibal in the Hurricane, and The Marvelous Catch of Old Hannibal, one of my son Dash's childhood favorites. Others took classic tales and added Louisiana flavor, like The Loup-Garou and The Cajun Gingerbread Boy, 3 Little Cajun Pigs, and A Cajun Little Red Riding Hood. Her young adult novels, The Mockingbird Song, Chalk Cross, and Secret Lives, drew on her native New Orleans. In Lost Magic, she wrote about the Middle Ages. She also wrote a cookbook, Delicious Dishes, Creole Cooking for Children, and a charming Christmas story, What Did You Lose, Santa? With her friend Eric Subin, she taught workshops on writing and illustrating children's books, and they published 2 invaluable guides for aspiring writers, Writing and Illustrating Children's Books, 2 Perspectives, and 10 Steps to Publishing Children's Books, How to Develop, Revise, and Sell All Kinds of Books for Children. For many years, she taught children's literature at Tulane University, and she was a longtime reviewer of children's books for the Times-Picayune, where I had the privilege of being her editor. She expanded her artistic work with a small publishing company called More Than a Card, creating cards and calendars carried in bookstores and museums around the country. And like many New Orleans women, she's also a celebrated hostess, bringing people together in her uptown home to meet visiting writers and illustrators. Baird is one of those writers who probably never thinks of what an example she sets for others, but she's been an inspiration to many women. She's lived all over the world. Hawaii, Germany, and Belgium were only a few of the stops her family made, with her husband Jimmy Amos, CEO of Likes Brothers Steamship Company. Their lifelong affection and support of one another is something wonderful to see. Baird is a model for all young women who wrestle with tough choices about work and motherhood, and now grandmotherhood. She simply does it all, just not all at once. This Saturday, Baird will be signing the sequel to her 1979 novel, a young adult mystery called Secret Lives. The new book is called Mischief and Magic. Secret Lives has been republished in a spiffy new edition by Lizzie Skernick Books, and it is good to see it back on the shelves. You can meet Baird from 11:30 to 1 Saturday at Maple Street Bookshop. At 89, she is still writing, still setting an example for us all. Thanks, Baird, and congratulations. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Pat and Patrick Sharon, a mother-son writing team from New Orleans, will discuss and sign copies of three new books, The Tavern, The System, and The Neighborhood, Tuesday, May 19th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Roberta Brandis Gratz signs We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City, Wednesday, May 20th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Universalist Church, 2903 Jefferson Avenue. Today's guest, Amy Connor, signs Million Dollar Road, Tuesday, May 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Muriel McHower, one of the first residents of the Lakeview neighborhood in New Orleans, discusses and signs her new book, Lakeview Memories, Tuesday, May 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Best-selling author Deborah Harkness signs The Book of Life, the third volume in the All Souls trilogy, Tuesday, May 26th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Today's guest, Barry Bronston, signs Walking New Orleans, Saturday, May 30th from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop. Baird Amos signs Mischief and Magic, Saturday, May 23rd from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop. And coming up, mark your calendar for the Symphony Book Fair, which will be held May 29th through 31st at the Human Performance Center at the University of New Orleans. And coming up in June, celebrate Bloomsday, June 16th, at the Irish House, with a cast of local characters reading from James Joyce's Ulysses. And congratulations are in order. Moira Crone's Ice Garden won a gold medal for the Southeast Best Regional Fiction and the Independent Publishers Regional and eBook Awards. Laura Kelly's The Irish in New Orleans won a bronze in regional nonfiction. And Carrie McCafferty's book, Luxury, Inequity, and Yellow Fever, won the Bronze Award for Best Nonfiction in the South, 2015. And congratulations to Sherry Fink, whose 5 days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital, won the prestigious Penn John Galbraith Award for Nonfiction. And Laura Lane McNeil's novel, Doll Baby, is a finalist for the SIBA Book Awards, to be announced July 4th. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.